Is it working?
We are working.
Okay. Holly, see the little things going.
It's on.
Okay. Testing, 1, 2, 3.
And I have a backup.
And a backup, good.
I don't trust technology.
And I signed the papers, so that's all done.
Okay, so we have two. I'm going to put them over here. These are microphones on either side.
Make sure you talk loud. You're very soft-spoken. I have a tendency to be a little bit louder. I think my hearing is slightly going.
Okay. We'll start now?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. This is Virginia Thomas, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Ms. Elaine Arnold. Today is Sunday, April 7th, 2013. It is about 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We are in Ms. Arnold's home in Sterling Heights, Michigan. Ms. Arnold, I'd like to begin with some biographical information about you. Could you tell me where and when you were born and a little bit about your early years?
St. Francis Hospital, Hamtramck, Michigan. I used to be teased that after I was born, they tore the hospital down. My father was a blue-collar worker. I remember him being out of work a lot. He was a hard-working man. My beginning years, I remember the Charles Housing Projects on Charles Street in Buffalo. Lived in a three-room unit, and then we moved to a... I think it was called a 4 or 5 room unit upstairs. I remember the address, 5820 Charles. From there, when my father found a job at Detroit Mold of Engineering, the projects at that time had a wage thing, so he had to find a regular house, and he built a house or had a house built on Dwyer, 12835. To Dwyer. It's funny. Those numbers I remember. So I grew up in a blue-collar area. We were just down the street from the Plymouth Lynch Road factory. Mm-hmm. I remember one of the stories that my dad told about getting part-time work at Plymouth's. He didn't have any tools. He took a screwdriver and some rocks and some pliers that he borrowed from my uncles, and he put them into a toolbox, and when he was going through the line, they would shake the box, and that's how he got to work at Plymouth's for 2 weeks. Okay. He collected newspapers, he collected scrap in between jobs. I grew up when times were very, very tough. I know what it's like to live off a garden. I know what it's like to have a father go to the neighborhood store and say to Charlie, I'd like some free soup bones because I have a great big giant dog and we didn't own one. Mm-hmm. It has to have a little bit of meat on it. Well, Mom would boil the heck out of those bones and then he would shave the meat off so we'd have meat on the table along with whatever produce we got out of the garden. So I know what it's like to grow up. My father said, we were never poor. We were rich. We were rich with, he always made sure the house payment was made. He made sure that the utility payments were made. My mother was a stay-at-home mom, as they all were back then. I went to Cass Tech, Technical High School, took 3 buses to go there. My father, at that time, I think he was making 25 or 35 cents an hour, maybe 50 cents. He had found a job at Detroit Mold and Engineering, which was on Manelliot and 6 Mile. And it was a challenge for him to give me bus fare and something to have for lunch and the books. But he did it because of the fact back then, a high school graduate, especially from Cass Tech, was like a college graduate now. So that's pretty basically my background. I studied commercial art, and I ended up in politics.
So when and why did you decide to run for Sterling Heights City Council?
We had an ordinance in the city. It was against recreational vehicles, and I had become quite involved. We had at that time a travel trailer, and they wanted to prohibit them. It's I just felt at that time it was an intrusive law, And I got involved, and the more I got involved, the more I got acquainted with politics. And I found myself, my Castec commercial art training, I found myself helping to design other people's literature. Back then, everything was done by hand. You took it into a printer and laying out stuff and typing. And I know, just sort of one thing led to another, and got acquainted with political people. And I don't know, just became a calling. Just happened.
So when were you first elected?
I was elected. I ran for county commissioner a couple times. Did very, very well, but I ran against an incumbent. And then I decided to run for Sterling Heights City Council. I figured I could do some good. I ran in 1993. I only served a 2-year term. And the reason the term, I was the top vote getter, by the way. I received over 10,000 votes. At that time, it was very unheard of. And my career was cut short, I feel, by the Detroit newspaper strike.
So 1995, when the strike began, was your last year?
Was my last year. In fact, when I lost the election, I had, I received less votes than I had yard signs. Further on in the interview, that will be explained. But I ended up receiving less votes than I had yard signs on people's lawns.
But were a number of the other members of City Council not reelected?
Sam Palazzolo lost. Eugene Soninski lost. Oh, goodness gracious, I can't remember the other fellow's name right now. Andy Zajcik lost. There's five of us that lost. Myself, Sam Palazzolo, Andy Zajcik. Eugene Soninski. Okay, Richard Nottie ran out of post, so he got back on. And Diana Koski got back on, and Jay Pollard got back on. But anybody that tried to help the strike, tried to see an end to that strike, lost.
Okay. So at the start of the Detroit newspaper strike in July of 1995, you had only held office for about a year and a half, is that?
About that, yeah.
Okay. What were your feelings about the strike when it began? What were your thoughts? Did you see it coming?
I think that your questions are going to be going. They're going to go too far in the future.
Tell me if you.
All right, I got aboard City Council. We had. I was definitely a blue collar thinker. Definitely. On council was Jay Pollard, mm-hmm. who was a right-wing wacko. You never knew exactly where he was coming from or why. He was against unions, even though he wanted Richard Nottie, who was a union Ford worker, he wanted Richard Nottie to get him into the union. Then there was Diana Koski. I never knew where she was coming from. Mm-hmm. Andy Zajcik and... Eugene Soninski were Republicans, I mean hardcore Republicans. Hindsight, I'll be able to fill in what was going on. I got on council and I was very, very diligent. I did my homework. I would ask questions constantly. One of my goals, I learned that from watching other politicians, if you have a particular goal for any reason, go for it the first year. One of my goals was to put up a memorial for the women that served in the military, past, present, and future. And now, like I said, hindsight will tell you 2020. When I was going down to Pat Lehman's office, she was the PR director for the city of Sterling Heights. Her office door was always closed. And I would have to wait 5, 10, 15 minutes for people to come out of that office. Coming out of that office would be Bill Driscoll, who wrote for the Macomb Daily, and police officers. And this was time and time again. And here I'm trying to work and solicit donations for this memorial. Never gave it a thought. I was new. Never gave it a thought. Come to find out, after I was out of office, what was going on in that room is that Bill Driscoll, along with the police officers and other reporters, were watching tapes from California, the strike in California. They were watching the correct way to handle a strike, the correct way to pull out the smallest or the largest, or what could be perceived as the troublemakers.
And this was back in
93? This was back in 93, 94. And I didn't know it. And what angers me today is everybody at City Hall held a union card, where we negotiated union contracts for them. Pat Lehman, our PR director, was in the union, and she never slipped any of us a note letting us know what was going on, including the police department. They are union. Well, of course, they're union at contract time in the city of Sterling Heights, and then when the strike came about, they said they were an association. They're union. They are union. They have contracts. They are union. And not one union person in the whole city hall ever even slipped us a note and let us know that this was going on.
Well, what did that mean to you when you found out about the videos and the planning? What did that tell you?
Well, I found out also that was done under the auspice of the only person that wasn't in the union was our city manager, Steve Duchesne. Steve Duchesne had been cooperating for 2 years before they were even in negotiations with the Detroit Newspaper Agency. And the union people in that city knew this was going on and never said a word. Today, this angers me. I think that every union person in the state of Michigan, whether they be a municipal union or a state union or a regular union for the big three or some other manufacturer or whatever, ought to be angered by this.
So are you?
We were blindsided. We were blindsided as council. We didn't have a clue this was going on. To have the police officers in the basement, at that time the PR department was in the basement in an allocated room, to be in the basement watching these tapes, being instructed how to form a V, how to bang on the shields, how to administer your tear gas, how to administer your pepper spray, and have the city manager sitting at the table with a Detroit newspaper agency planning all this, and the union people in that PR department knew it and never said a word. Yes, as you can hear in my voice right now, I'm angry.
So you're saying that a relationship was forming between members of the city council, the city manager, the police.
No, there was no relationship with the city council. We knew nothing. We absolutely knew nothing. The city council, the elected officials to protect the residents of the city of Sterling Heights, we knew nothing.
So the relationship was being formed between the city manager, the police department, and DNA before there was ever talk of strike.
Right. And the PR director downstairs, and I'm sure that there was other union workers down there in that office that knew what was going on and never, they could have slipped us a note. Never told us that there was a relationship going on. Yet in the meantime, we're negotiating contracts with our union brothers and sisters in that city. And they couldn't tell us.
So is it your feeling that the city man. This is something that
the
city manager.
I think the city. I think the city manager had a way of intimidating people. It was pretty obvious that he had a way of intimidating people. I would like to somewhere down the line talk to these people. I don't know if that will ever come to fruition. I would like to be able to look Pat Lehman in the eye and ask her why she did what she did. I hold her responsible for helping Steve Duchesne form this union with the Detroit Newspaper Agency. I got blamed during the strike of being involved. I had every right to be involved. I had every right to make sure that our laws were abided by. There was absolutely, this was collusion, this was bribery. It just was wrong. It was just plain wrong.
So when the strike began, you weren't surprised?
I was surprised. I was totally surprised. Again, I'm going to say, I did not know this was going on before the strike. I found this out after I was out of office.
I see.
And because I found this out after I was out of office, every time I think about it, it makes me angry. The first time, a couple times the city manager come up to me, he said, "What does Jerry tell you about the negotiations?" I says, "He doesn't tell me anything about the negotiations. It's his union." "Well, that's your husband. Steve Duchesne's the city manager." He says, "Well, what do you mean Jerry doesn't tell you anything?" I said, "Well, why should Jerry tell me anything about the negotiations? That's his union. That's for him to negotiate. It's nothing to do with us." City manager was trying to see if I knew anything. That snake had the audacity to question me when he already was talking to everybody at the Detroit Newspaper Agency and working with the police already against the workers. The first day of the strike, Jerry belonged to a golfing league through the Detroit Newspaper Agency. He called me up about 7, 8 o'clock, and he said, "We were notified out on a golf course." This was the golf course over here on, Sunnybrook. It's in Sterling Heights. That there would be a strike and more details. There would be a strike, more details to follow. They didn't even have picket signs yet. Then I got that was the call from my husband. Then I got another call, and for the life of me, I don't remember where it was from. I think it was anonymous. It said, "Councilwoman Arnold, I think you ought to go to 16 Mile and Mound. You ought to go see what's going on." I got in the car and went to 16 Mile and Mound. At that time, there was a place called the Paperclip. It was where the employees used to go and have lunch. We didn't have any McDonald's or Burger King's or anything like that back then. All we had was, that was the only eating place other than probably sandwiches at their lunchroom. I went down there and people were just milling around. They were talking about there's going to be a strike. And then all of a sudden, they're out of somewhere from the newspaper on the other side of the fence was these jackbooted. They look like something from the movie Cool Hand Luke. They had the blouse, black pants in jump boots, black shirts on, some kind of a cap pulled way over their eyes. They all had big dark sunglasses on, and every other one had a camera. Back then the cameras were large. They had cameras. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is weird. There isn't even a strike yet. I'm walking back and forth talking to the people. They said, yeah, we heard that we're on strike. This is the people that, some of the people that I knew from the newspaper. I knew a lot of the people. After all, my husband worked there. And police cars start pulling on the island across the street. Now, you have to understand, Mound Road's got five lanes going north and five lanes going south with an island in the middle. These police cars are pulling in and pulling in and pulling in and pulling in and pulling in. And this just didn't make any sense to me at all. So I went across the street to the paperclip, and I said to the owner of the paperclip, it was Jerry's wife. The owner's name was Jerry also. Miss Wiggins, and I said, can I use your phone? That's way before cell phones. Hardly anybody had a cell phone back then. I called the city manager at home. I told him to get down there. What's going on? Why do we have a police presence? What could he explain to me what was going on? So I hung up with him. I went back across the street to talk with the people. And this truck pulled into the middle gate. Well, they used to have all the gates open. This truck pulls into the middle gate. There's a bunch of little kids, younger people, behind the wheel of this truck. It was a white paneled truck, a small type truck, a little bit bigger than a van, but smaller than a big truck. And it pulled into the middle gate. And I remember one of the guys is beating on the hood of the car, not beating on it, but banging on it, saying, If you're a scab, you're going to the wrong gate. If you want to get inside this plant, you got to back up, you got to go around, you got to go into the other gate. So then he said, well, if you're a replacement worker or whatever's going on, he said, you're going in the wrong gate. All of a sudden, the police come across the street. They come running across the street. They grab this man who was doing nothing wrong. They pivoted him around and threw him up against the truck and cuffed him. Well, when Steve Duchesne came, I asked him, I said, what's going on? I saw the first arrest. And I says, and I'll be a witness. That man did nothing. If anything, he was telling the people, the driver and the passenger of that truck, that they were going to the wrong gate. Steve Duchesne, what kind of surprised me is Steve Duchesne was there awful quick. Later on in the story, you'll find out why. So we walked around, and a few of the people talked to Steve Duchesne, and they were explaining to him about what they were negotiating for, and he was talking with them, and I kept saying to him, is this necessary? He never gave me an answer. Never gave me an answer. I came home. I turned on the TV. I saw pictures on that TV from the angles that they were taking them that absolutely surprised me. This was early in the early. They said that they were making arrests. They didn't. They were making arrests. They were arresting people. I was trying to figure out why were they arresting people. They were showing people being put with these tabs, with these bands, and being taken away. I said, "This is it. I can't sit home." I got back in the car and went back over there. I said, what's going on? Why are the police, the cops, whatever, arresting people? They're arresting them for jaywalking. Jaywalking? There still was no real official strike. There was a handful of people that finally had picket signs. Mm-hmm. And they were marching at one of the gates. This was the It'd be the gate the farthest south of the Detroit News Plant. And my husband was there. He was talking with a few people, and he said, I'll tell you what. He says, I'll grab a picket sign. He says, and I'll walk for a while. And he says, and then we're going to go home. And I said, yeah, I think that'd be a good idea. I says, because I don't understand what's going on. I says, tomorrow, I says, I'm going down. I says, you know, I'm going to find out from the city manager just what in the H is going on around here. So I observed the people walking across the street. I also observed across the street there's police cars. There's police cars lined up, just lined up. There's police in riot gear, shields, helmets, batons, and there's a handful of strikers. And as a truck was to come in with the replacement workers, all they would do is they would walk their circle, and then the replacement workers would go in. Well, one of the guys, his name was Kenny Middleton, really real tall guy, he must be about 7'6". Anyways, there was a couple real, I'm 5'4", so he would call, there was a couple other girls about the same height. He turned around and he said, you know what? He said, I got a very, very uneasy feeling about this next time when they come over. He said, I don't know why, I got a very uneasy feeling. He said, I want you little girls, he says, to back up, get 15, 20 feet away from us when we walk the driveway. Oh, Kenny, nothing's going to happen. He's not. He says, just trust me. He says, I got this gut instinct. Something's going to happen. Okay, so we back up. Another truck is coming down. I hear her drums. Drums. It sounded like drums to me. Up until then, I didn't hear drums. Her drums. And I had just had oral surgery. I was just getting over oral dental implants. And I had quit smoking. And I said to one of the girls, I says, I'm a nervous wreck. I says, throw me a cigarette. I went to light the cigarette, and I looked up, and I didn't see Kenny get hit, but blood was coming out of his nose and his mouth, and he was like twirling and weaving and twirling and weaving, and bam, he hit the gravel up towards, closer to the Detroit newspaper agency. And he laid there on the ground. I froze. I did not know what to do. I froze. I thought he was killed. One of the people had a phone. And he said, I've got a phone. And he threw the phone to me. And I said, I don't know how to work this thing. He did something to the phone to make sure it would work. I pressed 0 for operator. We still had operators back then. I said to the operator, I said, I don't know what happened. I says, but I need to get a hold of the sheriff's department. Somebody from the sheriff's department was on the other end of the phone. And I said, I don't know what's going on. I says, but the police department just hurt a striker, and they did nothing wrong. They just hurt a striker, and he's laying there on the pavement in the gravel. Can you send the sheriff's department out here? And her reply to me is, we've already been notified. They had already been notified. I didn't have a clue who notified them. So I hung up and I said, I called the sheriff's department. They said they've been notified. So then I said to him, I said, give me the phone back. I got back on the phone, and I called the fire department, our fire department in the city of Sterling Heights. If anybody ever gets sick in the city of Sterling Heights, we have the best trained paramedics. If God wants to give you a second chance, they're going to help them. They are the best trained in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I have seen their training. They are awesome. So anyways, I called the fire department and I said, one of the strikers is hurt. I don't know how bad. I said, we pulled him from where he was laying. I said, we've got a handful of teeth. We put him in water. We put him in water. I had heard that if you put the teeth in water, they can push him back in the mouth. And I said, we're afraid to send him across the street to the police. I'm afraid to send him across the street to the police. Here I am sitting as a sitting council person, and I am afraid to send an injured person across the street to the police. I was terrified. And Kenny a couple times got up and he said, by the way, it's Mr. Middleton, but I knew him as Kenny. Never broke bread with him, just knew him as Kenny, okay? A couple times he was going to stand up and he was going to go across the street. We told him, no, you just stay here, the fire department's coming. And we waited and we waited and we waited and we waited for this fire department to come. It seemed like forever. It took them about a half an hour or better. I called the fire department and told them to come out. We had an injured person. And they got in their truck immediately. I called fire station right here in 15 Mile. So now the plant's between 15 Mile and 16 Mile. Didn't realize it at the time, but the police had barricaded Mound Road between 15 and 16.
So they couldn't get out.
There was no traffic. There was no witnesses. Absolutely no traffic going north and no traffic going south. They had barricaded that. I called our mayor, and he went across the street immediately. And he was the one that said to me, Elaine, didn't you notice that the street was blocked? There was so much that went on that till today, I just, even giving this interview, I'm shaking inside. To witness somebody going down like that. What happened was, is one of the officers come across the street, he took his shield, and he jammed it right straight up where it grazed Kenny's lips and up under his nose. And Kenny was slightly buck teeth, so it caught his teeth and it pulled up his teeth out. We rinsed Kenny off, and then eventually, after Richard Noddy came, Kenny Middleton was walked across the street, and he was taken to the ambulance. By the way, Universal Ambulance had also cut a deal with the Detroit Newspaper Agency. They were on Treasure Island. It became known as Treasure Island. They were already stationed on Treasure Island. Later on, during the strike, we found out that Universal Ambulance was giving hot meals, showers, and sleep time to the officers. And they had a contract with the city to provide ambulance service. Well, evidently, they had cut a different deal with the city manager and the Detroit Newspaper Agency because they were giving mutual rest, food, and showers to the police officers.
When the city contracts with outside agencies, is the city council normally involved?
Yes, ma'am. That was not part of their job description. That was not part of their job description to be there and give food and shelter and sleeping quarters to the police officers. That was not part of their job description. Their job description is to transport. Now, if somebody got hurt, an ambulance would be called, and then they would come and they would take care of them. But Universal Ambulance was already stationed on Treasure Island. Anyways, getting back to that night, I went across the street. My son was with me. Jerry was with me. There was a couple other people were with me. There was a couple representatives from the Teamsters Union. I was so green as to what was going on with the strike. I didn't know it was six separate unions. I was not involved with them. I thought everybody was one union, like my dad worked with one union. Mm-hmm. Anyways, later I found out it was Teamsters, it was Typographical, it was CWA, it was Local 13. I can't think of the other two. It was the Reporters. There's another one, the sixth one. I can't think of what it is.
So all of those formed the Metropolitan Council. And that's
of unions, yes. But, the negotiations was with all six. Anyways, there was two representatives there that happened to be there, and one was John Peralta, and why can't I remember the other young fellow's name? Well, later on, if you ever do a documentary, look up his name. Anyways, Steve Duchesne was there. Steve Duchesne was with the police department. I walked up to him and I looked at him. I just stood there and looked at him. I could not believe my eyes. I had called him and asked him, was this necessary? Why are we doing this? And there he is with the police department. Part of the instructions, I guess. I don't know. A few words were exchanged between Steve Duchesne and I, but this I'll never forget. Steve Duchesne looked at me and he said, "They better do as they promised." I said, "What?" He said, "They better pay for this as they promised." And I said, "Who?" And he said, "The newspapers. They better pay for this as promised." All right. Next day later, I don't know, I didn't keep a log. My whole life from then on was turned upside down. We had fax machines. That was about the only electronic extras that people had at that time. I think it was about 3 or 4 days later. The Detroit Newspaper Agency had given a check to the city of Sterling Heights for something like $200,000 for the overtime that the police officers have put in so far. And in their PR, in the Detroit Newspaper Agency's PR, and the city manager's, the residents, they turned union brother against union brother. Believe me, they did a good job of it. It's called greed. They were blaming the strikers for the money that would cost the city of Sterling Heights for their horrible strike. And this is why we had to accept the money from the Detroit Newspaper Agency to pay for the police officers' overtime. The police officers didn't belong there to begin with. And boy, I got chastised for making that statement. I had got chastised when you folks finally look at those tapes to the council meetings after the strike had hit. You will see how anybody who stuck up for workers was ridden out of town on a rail.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of those early council meetings?
Oh, they were horrible. The Joe Munim and Joyce Snow Fitch, S-N-O-W is her married name, married to a teacher from Stevenson High School, a history teacher, I think, or was he a math teacher? I don't remember, but a teacher, a union teacher, who always spoke ill of the unions, hated the unions, wanted to destroy the unions, gave speech after speech after speech at the council meetings against unions. Her and her little protege, Jay Pollard at the time, who sat on council. That's my train of thought. Anyways, her, Joe Munim, and of course the Detroit newspaper strike, because the news media just absolutely couldn't. It was the biggest event of the century. It was an absolute circus there because these strikers were causing all these problems. These strikers weren't causing any problems. The first arrests of the first day of the strike were for jaywalking. They were for milling. They were for anything they wanted to make arrests. They made it look bad. Arrests, the police officers would come across the street. They would break through an organized picket line. They would pick out people and they would drag them out and they would arrest them. And it just escalated. And I remember Jerry's got the number, but I think there was they tried to get everybody. There was the sheriff's department was called. It was horrible. It was just plain horrible. These council meetings, the newspaper would come out. They would scream and yell at us. They would tell us that we were costing, the strikers were costing the city money.
The Detroit Newspaper Agency had every right to pay for the overtime. I was trying to say that the newspapers and the union should sit down and bargain in good faith. I even brought forth a legal resolution that the newspapers and the Detroit Newspaper Agency should bargain in good faith. And I was told that I had no business interfering in the strike. This was my city. It looked like a war zone. This was my city. I was trying to stop this carnage. It was carnage.
So the Detroit Newspaper Agency was present at city council meetings on a regular basis?
Well, I don't know if they were present at city council meetings, but they were pulling the strings. Joyce Snow Fitch, S-N-O-W, Fitch, F-I-T-C-H, she took an alias as Fitch because her husband belonged to the teachers' union. She was one of the spearheaders to come to the meetings and scream and yell at us, along with Joe Munim. Some of those meetings are a blur. I'd have to rewatch them. When you folks start rewatching them, then you can come back and ask me some more questions. Sure. But they were chaotic. They were horrible. I remember at one of the meetings, it was so bad. I really thought the people on strike started to come to try to counteract this, and they would get on the podium and they would try to talk and they would try to give their part of what was going on. I came out of one of the meetings one night, and on the back of a pickup truck was a hanging noose? It was a hanging noose. And there was a rope hanging from it. And people were screaming, "This is for you, Arnold. This is for you, Councilwoman Arnold." I was terrified. My phone was tapped. I had called, at that time, AT&T. My phone was tapped. I found out my phone was tapped. It was chirping. I couldn't figure out why my phone would chirp. I called the operator. She said to me, "When a phone does that, that means it's tapped." She said, "Where do you live?" I told her. She says, "We'll send somebody out." The phone was tapped in the backyard. It was tapped at the on Ryan Road in the main box. It was tapped. They took the lines and put the lines where they were supposed to be. My husband would go to serve his time on the picket line. My phone would ring. I would have some character, they would block their numbers. I have some character on the other end telling me exactly what he had on, what color his scarf was, and what gate he was at. I would wake up in the middle of the night to loud noises in front of the house, and then the Hoffmaster goons would be setting out in front of the house at that time in Ford Tauruses, big black Ford Tauruses, and pickup trucks. And they would be sitting out there. They would have phones in their hands just as for intimidation. Some of the neighbors were scared. They says, "What? Do something about it." I said, "I can't do anything about it. Who am I going to call? Sterling Heights Police? They're not going to come up for me. You got to call." Finally, they started calling. And when they started calling, it started subsiding a little bit. Jerry and I were eating supper. It was the middle of the afternoon. There was some character sitting out in front of the house, and he had this big, back then the cameras were really, really big. He had this big old camera, and he was taping anybody that was coming in and out of the house. He was taping us. We ran him off. He had no business sitting out in front of the house taping me. I don't know how many times I knew I was followed. I did some very creative driving. I was terrified, but who am I going to complain to?
Do you think other members of the city council were treated similarly?
I don't know if you're going to get an interview from him. I'm not going to give you his name. One of the workers from one of the let me put it to you this way: there were city employees that told me that when they showed any kind of sympathy towards the workers, or they went out to the workers and gave them water bottles, or they went out to the workers and gave them a six-pack of Coca-Cola, or they went out to the workers and brought them some sandwiches, the police were filming anybody and everybody that helped them, that happened to come across the street and help the strikers. It was all on their films. They were constantly filming. Constantly. And some of the city workers told me that their wives were pulled over, given talking to's, and they were being followed. I cannot and will not give you their names unless they come forward. I don't know if they're still scared. I don't know if they'll come forward. All you're going to have to do is trust me that they told me that.
That must have been
one worker was terrified, yet he would come out to the line periodically with sandwiches and stuff.
It must have been very difficult.
It was very difficult.
Living in Sterling.
It was very difficult. And let me tell you, the UAW, the Communication Workers of America, and the Greater Detroit Building Trades were awesome. And the Detroit Teachers Union, to name a few, but these are the ones that stand out, came out to the strike line and helped walk picket lines. They made sure that there was water. They made sure there was help. When the strikers were being tear gassed, I mean, you know, you're being tear gassed. You've seen it just lately in Occupy Wall Street. Mm-hmm. Them girls sitting there doing nothing, doing absolutely nothing, sitting there being young girls, fighting for a cause. You know, in the United States of America, you feel that this is not the Tiananmen Square in China where a tank is going to roll over you, but I'm beginning to wonder. You saw this with Occupy Wall Street. How they said it was going to cost these cities all this money because these people were occupying the parks. You know, they turned the minds of the average person by claiming money. That's when greed sets in, which is the biggest bunch of bull that they can throw at the residents. And you get tear gassed. Why? Because you're walking a picket line? Why? Because you're trying to bring attention that things aren't fair here in the United States? I don't know. I'm glad my father didn't live to see this because he fought for the unions. My father fought for the unions. My mother got fired because the whistle blew at Bone Aluminum and she stood up for the union. Her and two other women were the only two that stood up, so they fired him on the spot. So I come from a long line of union people. I remember one of my dad's union contracts. He was given a 15-minute lunch in a 10 or 12-hour day. And we went to Sears, and he bought a black lunchbox with a thermos so he could have coffee and a half a sandwich in his 15 minutes. So, you know, unions really, you know, they really just tear this country apart. 15-minute lunch was negotiated with my dad's plant, Detroit Mold and Engineering, back in what, 1951. But you asked the council meetings. I tried. I had two resolutions. The second resolution is when was my complete demise. I had presented a resolution to council that at that time Janet Reno investigate the Detroit newspaper agency and the unions and make them sit at the bargaining table is kind of the gist of the resolution. Somewhere in the cleaning of my house I'm going to find that resolution. But that's when the wheels really started turning against me.
So how did the city council overall respond to these events?
There was only two. Deanna Koski, whose husband was a union person.
She's still a member of
council.
She's
still a member of council. She did nothing. She sat there
she sat there like a stone. And her husband went and cooperated with Jay Pollard to, as he said, my wife will get reelected. He said, well, I can't really repeat the words he said, but he said, gee, she has nothing to do with these strikers. And yet he was retired from the UAW. Not all union people are good people. That was a piece of work. Mr. Kosky is a piece of work. And she cooperated with Jay Pollard. And, of course, newspaper industry wanted to make sure that their cronies would get back in. She got back in. Jay Pollard got back in. I can't even remember who else. Kim Wiggins got in. I don't remember who the other council people were that got back in. Romano got back in, or got in. Who are the other two? I don't remember now. Anyways, that can be looked up. That can be looked up. The day of... Now, I... in the meantime, Andy and Eugene, they weren't sure about what Andy and Eugene would do. In the meantime, there was this bogus thing put up against Andy and Eugene that they had taken a bribe. They didn't. It was later proved they didn't take a bribe. Well, they lost the election because they were called the bribery guys. They never took a bribe. They wanted to make sure that the right ones were eliminated. And so that was started before the strike, being accused of taking a bribe. And they were nice guys, and whether they were accused of that or not, I don't think they would have stood for this nonsense of what was going on that strike line. Sam Palazzolo was vocal. He could not understand what was going on. Richard Notte ran on a poll, so he got back in. It was made very clear to him after the election that he better mind his P's and Q's.
In I believe it was September in 1995, the council passed an ordinance to prevent residential picketing.
Sure. Steve Rice got
can
in.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, what
motivated that?
What motivated that? In this country, supposedly we have the right to peaceful protesting. Well, if you have, let me put it to you this way. We have protests all the time against family planning clinics. Family planning clinics do more than the so-called right wing says that they do abortions. Family planning clinics take care of children, women, even men who are in desperate need of medical care. Mm-hmm. Now, there's protests around them all the time. There have been protests in the past against doctors who work at these family planning clinics in front of their homes. Nobody said anything. They're allowed. Well, in order to try to put the pressure and get these people, get the Detroit newspaper agency to the negotiating table, there was people that were supposedly good union people, but who had cut some very good financial deals with the Detroit newspaper agency, crossed the line. One of them's Mitch Albom, and I wouldn't buy his book if it was the last piece of crap that ever hit the pavement. Mitch Albom, oh, I'll go on to him in a minute. Anyways, getting to these neighborhood. So what these were neighborhood protests. Mitch Albom's house was, he was protested for being a, as the term is called, a replacement worker or scab. I'm sorry, but there are terms given to people that cross picket lines. Mm-hmm. There was different people that lived in Sterling Heights, and they did protest marches around their house to draw attention to other union people that lived down the street, other UAW, Greater Detroit Building Trades, whatever union they happened to belong to, that this is wrong. This is a person that walked across the picket line. Mm-hmm.
So in the ultimate wisdom of the council, which would they were already, they were handpicked by the Detroit Newspaper Agency, and Steve Duchesne was still at the helm, they decided that, oh, this wasn't very nice. Mm-hmm. So we're going to pass an ordinance that you're not allowed to picket in front of somebody's house. I went to the council meeting on that one, and I said, you know what? I said, you're making a big mistake, because someday there's going to be a drug dealer. There's going to be an abortionist that you don't like. You're going to call them an abortionist, and you're going to want to picket their home. You're not going to be able to, but they passed it anyways. See, they pass things when it's convenient for them to pass things against workers. No different than this last election. I equate all of this going down with what's happening today. It was already planned. This was not spontaneous by the right wing, by management, by the one percenters, by the haters of union. This was already in the works, along with destroying the teachers' union by making academies, and academies are wrong. They're schools for profit. They've sent all our work out of town. How do you expect the economy to come back? I don't see the prices any cheaper. I don't see the garment industry any cheaper. They said China can make it cheaper. I don't know. We used to have a choice. We'd go to Walmart's and get stuff that you could wash a half a dozen times. You bought them for your kids, and you knew they were going to grow out of them, so you didn't worry about going to Macy's to buy their clothes. And my grandmother taught me, and so did my parents, if you wash things properly, they last forever, no matter where you buy them from. And if you lose a button, you sew it back on. So we had the high to the low to the medium. This newspaper strike is the start of it. I really feel between California and Michigan, it was the start of it.
For people, I would imagine that the residents of Sterling Heights had to be affected in some way, whether you were a protester or a striker or...
What they did with the residents of Sterling Heights, I even had some of the city workers. I had one city worker that I dearly loved this young man. He said to me, Elaine, we have to take the money from the police officers because it's going to cost me in my taxes. I said, would you stop and smell the coffee? We wouldn't need this money from the Detroit Newspaper Agency. The police have no business on that island. He says, all I see is trouble. I says, why don't the police go home? You won't see no trouble. They're the ones that are provoking it. In fact, one of the comments that the city manager made to me, one of the big weekends, he said, what are those people made out of, Elaine? And at that point, I didn't want to even look at him, let alone talk to him, and I just stared at him. He said, I'm asking you a question. What are those people made out of? I said, they're tough. He said, boy, they sure as hell are. He says, the cops threw tear gas at him, pepper spray, and everything we could throw at him. And he said, and they were gagging and throwing up and coughing and coming back for more. He says, we even turned the fans on them. He says, and we just couldn't bring them down. I think it's time the people know the attitude. The attitude against somebody who wants to go on an official strike. Those are quotes from the city manager. We couldn't bring them down.
As you reflect on your experiences with the strike and the years before the strike, was there a point at which you thought things were out of hand? And what was that point? What was the turning point for you?
To where? Out of hand where?
Things were beyond the control of...
The strike?
The government.
Oh, with government?
City council and you know, just normal management of business of
the strike. After the first day of the strike, I knew it was out of hand. I knew that we were bought and paid for. There was no doubt in my mind. We were bought and paid for. I mean, let me tell you how bad we were. The city was bought and paid for. The Salvation Army was on Treasure Island giving the police officers sandwiches, water, and coffee. The Salvation Army. As far as I'm concerned, I will never give the Salvation Army a dime. If I find the dime, it's going somewhere else. I am not supposed to. I am supposed to forgive them. I'm sorry, but I will take my money and I will put it where it's supposed to go. Why was the Salvation Army there to begin with, giving mutual aid to the police officers? It was so horrible there. They turned neighbor against neighbor. Do you know, which I will take you to that site later, that there's an apartment house there and there's slight berms. People would come on weekends and bring a picnic lunch and their kids, just like they did during the Civil War, to watch the action of the strike. Also, there was a woman who was the afternoon delight. She was bedding down with Norm Nowak, one of the cops. She was a former councilwoman. She was always questioning me on different things, and I got as far away from her as I could. But she was up there after I was no longer on council. She was up there on that hill with a camera filming from this side to see if she could catch the strikers do anything so the copper, the as she put it, so that the police would have it. They had people on all sides. When you'd go on the other side of the street as mutual aid to show support after the strike was over, on the other side, way on the other side, and sit there, you had to be careful who you talked to. You didn't know who you were going to be talking to. And I knew this was not good. When you had, I can't think of his name, but I can picture him. He was supposed to be the liberal of the free press. I can't think of his name. He crossed the line with Mitch Albom, and there was another reporter. Come to find out, they had already had a contract with the newspaper agency that if they crossed the line, they got big bucks. Ah, wonderful. Mitch Albom, who does all this stuff for charity. Judas, he's a Judas. I wouldn't buy his book. I will help the charity. How can he in good conscience say that he helps people? He crossed a picket line with a contract that he had signed against his brothers and sisters in the guild. The guild, that's the sixth union. The guild. He's a Judas. And I believe in karma. So Mitch Albom, you better watch out, because I'm not going to get you. Karma's going to get you. But I'll never buy one of your books.
Ms. Arnold,
and at this point, my comments are very, very rough because of the point. I don't care anymore. I can see what's going on with this world. I don't care. It's got to be told. Oh, go back to the first night. I left out a very important thing. You're going to have to kind of piece this together. When the fire department came to help Ken Middleton, mm-hmm. I went to go up to the fire department to talk to him, and they waved me away. And I trusted them. They waved me away for a reason. And then a couple police officers came to talk to the driver. And they talked to them quite a long time. The police officers would not let the fire department get out of their truck and help Ken Milton.
Why do you think that was?
Because that's what... I have no idea. I think that's horrible. The fire department is there
to save lives and to give first aid. The police department would not let them. I don't know. I guess you have to ask the police department. You have to ask Steve Duchesne why they wouldn't. Steve Duchesne was on the island. I didn't know he was there, but Steve Duchesne was on the island. Evidently, it must have been orders from him. I don't know. This is just speculation. I don't know. Somebody's eventually going to have to ask the police department and Steve Duchesne why they would not let the fire department help Ken Middleton. And then Steve Duchesne, at the next council meeting, lied to me and he said, Ken Middleton had a partial plate. Who are you kidding? And I said, excuse me, I saw his teeth. We put his teeth in water. We put his teeth in water. We were looking for milk. We had heard that you either keep the teeth in milk or water so that they can be put back into the mouth. And when Ken Middleton finally went to the emergency room, they said it was too long. They couldn't put his teeth back in. I had heard that they could push the teeth back in. Right. Yeah, now he wears a partial plate. And he did nothing wrong. All he did was walk a picket line. He had a premonition. And they took out the biggest guy, of course. He was about, I don't know, he was way over 6 feet tall. I mean, way over. He was a seven. I mean, he was just a bean. Just a bean all the way up. You didn't talk to him, you go like this.
There were a number of civil rights suits that were filed against Sterling Heights by protesters after they alleged being physically harmed. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the reaction of the city council was.
What protesters?
Picketers, strikers. Ben Solomon was one. Vito Ciuto.
Federal
civil.
Ben Solomon. What was the other one?
Ben Solomon. Vito Ciuto was one. James McConchick was another. They were injured.
I know they were injured. The only one that I knew about was Ben Solomon, and I really think the reason they picked him out of the crowd is back then it was very unusual for a young man to wear an earring, and he worked out. He was quite muscular. He used to wear tight t-shirts, and he also his ethnicity. Mm-hmm. He's got very dark, coarse hair that would either pillow out like a bushel, like an afro, mm-hmm. or he would pull it back, and he would have a very long, tight ponytail. Mm-hmm. The ponytail came down to the middle of his back. And I feel, this is my gut feeling, I have no way of proving it, but I think Ben was pulled out because of the fact he looked like what would be considered a 60s hippie. They had him on the island quite a long time. Quite a long time. He was injured very, very badly. His injuries still haunt him today. I can't say too much because of the fact with his lawsuit, he's not allowed to talk, and I don't know if I'm allowed to talk. But there was one lawsuit. Well, what's the other name?
There's a Vito Ciuto and James McConchick, who were both injured.
McConchick. Was that the one that was kicked by Jack the Kicker?
I believe Mr. McConchick was run over by a truck. And
I had heard about those.
That's what the allegation was.
Heard about those. I would have probably already been off council. I had heard about those. I was chastised at council meetings for going on a picket line. While I was on council, I went a couple times just to see what was going on, but
This would have been at the tail end.
But I mean, I was chastised while I was on council because the police officer said that I was on the picket line, and I said, so I went to see what was going on. Aren't I allowed to? I'm not sitting on council. But I'll tell you, they turned this community, they turned the community around in a heartbeat from a very hardworking middle-class, blue-collar community. It got turned around in a heartbeat, and it all had to do with, they kept saying, that those strikers are making our taxes go up, and I'll tell you what made our taxes go up. I'll explain what made our taxes go up. Back then, the police officers had a contract that the best two, they received 80% for their retirement. Some of these police officers retired at 80, 90, and 100,000.
Excuse me, do you mean that the best, highest 2 years?
Highest 2 years. And guess where the highest 2 years? They were serving 24 hours a day. Detroit newspaper agency was paying for their triple, double, quadruple time. Uh-huh. And they were chalking up time towards their retirement.
I see.
80% of the best 2 years. I can't say they were all bad. Now, let me back up on that one. There was police officers that told me they did not want to be there. They were told to be there. They didn't care about the overtime. They liked looking in a mirror. They told me to watch my back. They were telling me in a nice way, watch your mirror, watch your back. They did not want to be there. I've even run across some of them today, and they look at me, and they get a tear in their eye, and they tell me, we are so sorry. But it wasn't all of us. I believe them. It was not all of them. But they are given an order by Constitution, by city charter, between that corrupt city manager and whatever the police chief told them to do or their captains or whatever, they had to be there. So I do not fault the whole police department. Never, ever. But I was written up as saying that they were all a bunch of bums. Uh-uh. No way. There's no way they were all a bunch of bums. Some of them I've run across today, and I'm not kidding you, for one reason or another, and they look at me and they... just out of the blue, they'll say, I'm sorry. I don't question why they've said that. I know why they've said that. I'm sorry. There, you know, we have some of the finest people that were on that police department at that time, but we also had some real bad apples. Like the one that kicked that guy, the one that was on the billboard over there on I-75. He was off duty. I mean, let's face it, you got bad apples in any place where you work. So, you know, I want that cleared. I want that clear for the record from now on forever. There was some bad apples. But also, some of them bad apples, greed set in. They got 80% of the best 2 years. I mean, when they're getting over $1,000 a week, yeah, take home. I mean, you know, figure it out. Double time, triple time, quadruple time, however they were doing it. And our fire department, They were asked to hose the workers down in the middle of winter. And our fire department said, no way. We are trained paramedics to save lives. We will not hurt people. Don't ask us again. And for some reason, they dropped it. I'm proud of those boys and girls. But I'm also proud of the part of the police department that didn't want to be there. I'm proud of them. You know.
What's the impact today of the strike? How has that changed the life of people?
Well, you can see as I'm talking about it, I'm all emotional in it. I'll never lose this emotion. How has it impacted me? I remember walking around for a couple weeks or better. I couldn't sleep. I was having nightmares. I was watching Kenny stagger and stumble and fall into the gravel, and I'd wake up, and that kept going through my mind and going through my mind. Finally, a good friend of mine from one of the unions, I got to talking to him about it, and I said, I feel so guilty. And, oh, he was so sweet. He said, you saw your first casualty of war. I'm like, what? And he said, did you wet your pants? I said, no. He said, well, you did better than a lot of soldiers. Which he got me to laugh. And I said, I froze. I said, I froze. He could have died. He says, you didn't freeze as long as you think you froze. He says, you probably froze a total 5 seconds. He says, no, you froze. You saw your first casualty of war. He says, but you did go up to him, didn't you? He says, you did wash his face, didn't you? He says, you didn't worry about your safety. You grabbed a cell phone and you called. You stayed with him until he went to the ambulance. Then you went home. He said, you saw your first casualty of war. I want you to start sleeping. He was a Vietnam veteran. But there is just so much that went on. And I mean, this interview is, I hope your teacher allows you to come back and dive into it more. But us council people, we were blindsided. We were totally blindsided. One of the things that we passed, I found that out later from talking with one of the reps who was telling me about the court case. He said, do you remember passing the budget? He says, for the tear gas and stuff. I said, wait a minute. I never passed a budget for a tear gas. He said, well, let me explain something to you. He says, this is what came out in court today. He said, do you remember one of the council meetings where you passed out special riot equipment for the police department? I says, yes, under the auspice of Clinton's, what was that called now? See, this is why you got to get this stuff from me before I get too old. Clinton's domestic something or other act, okay? Domestic violence act? I don't remember. Maybe I'm wrong now, but anyways, it had something to do with something that Clinton was doing to make sure that everybody had the proper equipment to fight crime. It was presented to us as that. And this union person told me that at the court case that he was at, it wasn't part of Clinton's act. It was paid for by the Detroit Newspaper Agency. Now, that's somebody's going to have to research it and find it. It had something to do with the Detroit Newspaper Agency paying for tear gas, pepper spray, Kevlar, some kind of special shirts that had metal woven in it in case somebody tried to knife them. There's a whole list of stuff. I had it all cataloged at one time. I don't know what happened to it all. You know, you save it. Nobody wants it, so it sort of gets tucked. But anyways, this was the equipment that they used out there in that strike line. It was batons and tear gas and fans to blow tear gas.
So this was an ordinance to...
No, it wasn't an ordinance. It was a budget measurement
to pass this so that this money could be allocated to go into this budget.
Allocation, okay.
And then, see, I found out after I was out of council that one of the union reps said he was at the court case, and he said, "Did you know?" And I said, "Of course not." He said, "Well, that's what, you know, they kid with you. That's why we're telling you. Did you know it was for the strike?" I says, "No, it was supposed to be Clinton's, what the heck did Steve Duchesne call it?" Which made sense at the time. We had no, you know, it was on there, and we read it, and all in favor say aye, and it was aye. And that's where the tear gas and all that stuff came from.
But if it was a measure to approve, to appropriate funds for these items, how could Detroit...
I don't know. Somebody's got to research it. I guess what it was is matching funds. We matched...
Oh, I see.
We matched X amount, but what came out in court that we didn't match government funds, we matched Detroit Newspaper Agency funds. I don't know. That's vague with me. Somebody'd have to research that, which is another important part of connecting the dots. See, these are bits and pieces that I have no way of finding out. I'm no longer in council.
You have been telling me how important you think the relationship between the DNA and the Sterling Heights police and maybe other administrators in Sterling Heights is to the story of the strike.
Well, basically, I would the one I have a hard time with Pat Lehman. Pat Lehman was a head of the PR department downstairs. Somebody could have slipped us a note. I have a hard time with her doing what she did. And Steve Duchesne. How many other administrators were involved? I don't know. And I'll probably never know. Probably a lot of us will never know. Unless somebody, as the story progresses and as somebody does a documentary on it, somebody else comes through with some more information. There's a lot of things I'd like to know. I'd like, before I check out.
How do you think the strike has affected the community's view or confidence in the local government of Sterling Heights?
Has it had
an impact?
I don't know. I couldn't even begin to speculate. Once I lost my council seat, I just do my own thing, pick my own little battles, and watch the news and make sure I vote appropriately. I was destroyed. I had a chance to do some real good things, and I was destroyed. I mean, my tenure, that quick 2 years wasn't just the strike. I pushed. At that time, the DPW was their oil changes. Was good oil. Every car, everything in the fleet has to have so many, it's a very low number of miles of oil has to be changed. And the oil that was going in these barrels, they said, was almost as pure as it went in. And in order to conserve and to save money and to, so that we could do other things for the community, because I feel a person in office, including all of us in office, the government is to secure the health, safety, and welfare of all its residents. We aren't doing this anymore. So this measure of taking this oil and putting it into this oil-burning furnace at the DPW yard saved them hundreds and thousands of dollars. That was because I pushed for it. So I wasn't there just rah, 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 strike. You know, that to me was very, very important. I got a monument to the women that served in the military. I was being pressured as to pick a war, and I said, no, this is to honor the women from the time of, one if by sea, two if by land or something, you know, and to now.
And the monument is the shape of a mitt, and it's all five branches of the service, and it says, "We salute women in the military." To me, that was important. I'm glad I got that done right away. That's where I saw the police coming out of Pat Lehman's office. And that didn't cost the taxpayers a dime. I worked hard on that and got donations. And most of the donations came from the big donations. Most of them came from unions and churches. So you tell me, you union people are bad people. So, you know, it just, I don't know. How has it impacted the community? I don't know. I do know that a lot of people, Steve Duchesne snowed a lot of people. There was a lot of people that thought he was the greatest thing since John Wayne and apple pie. But eventually, what he did is going to come out. He was not on a level. What he did was wrong. Totally wrong. And he's got himself to live with. I sleep good at night. I still have a nightmare every once in a while about Ken. Probably always will. And then you asked about Benny Solomon. Benny Solomon and his wife, she got pregnant during the strike. She had a strike baby. But was meant to be. And Benny was going through all those operations and everything, but they came through it. Their faith in God.
He won his lawsuit.
I know he won his lawsuit, but that money means nothing. He does not have his health. And the lawsuit was kept quiet. Do people know that the city had to pay? No. Do the people know how much the city paid? No, because in court it says nobody can talk about it. Do these people know? They still think Steve Duchesne saved them money by taking money from the Detroit newspaper agency. They don't know it cost us in retirement, that it cost us in lawsuits, because these lawsuits are kept quiet. If a person got $5, $6, $7, $10, $20, $30 million, residents will never know. That's not fair that the people don't know what Steve Duchesne and the Detroit newspaper agency did to them. Now, are you going to get with Jennifer and her notes?
That's a separate interview. So.
Well, you should, because of the fact my husband came home and he could tell you about how the Hoff master people came into the plant and to do their intimidation. I'm going to, as I start feeling better, my stuff. I'm pretty sure somewhere in this house I've got a picture of them standing on the other side of the fence, their glasses and their camera. Unless I have a picture up here in my brain computer. You know, sometimes you think you have a picture and it really is in your head. So I will look and see if I have one.
Okay. That would be great. I'm going to...
Would you like...
I'm going to ask if you have, before I turn the recorder off, if you have anything else you'd like to say right now and during this conversation.
Oh, I want to see this made for History Cable Channel. I want everybody to know. I mean, my husband and I are now in our 70s. I want you to interview the people that were involved in. And I mean, the History Channel can waste their time with motorcycle gangs, and they can get this out there for people to know.
Absolutely.
You know, it's time. Its time has come, and they ought to know. I wish I could think of that other newspaper reported across the line. I can pick McDermott. McDermott. What was his first name? See, when you start talking about it, things start popping back in. What was his first name? He had dark hair. He combed it straight back. It was him, Mitch Albom, and some and a couple other reporters. Oh, when I was was a 2-year term, and when I was running, I said I lost the election. I had less votes than I had signs on the lawn, and a lot of the houses that I had signs on the lawn, they had anywhere from 2 to 7 people that would have voted for me. The day of the election, we had the punch card system. Mm-hmm. People came in. There was people that were living in Sterling Heights, mm-hmm. in different neighborhoods. They were planted ahead of time. They were the ones that would tell the neighbors that the strikers were no good. They were already working at the Detroit News or had some sort of affiliation with them. And they were registered voters. Anyways, people came into all 15, 20 precincts, whatever they are. They either took an X-Acto knife and cut our names off, or they stuck super glue in the slots so votes weren't being cast. We were blindsided. We had no challengers. The unions had no challengers. We were blindsided. There was people complaining they couldn't cast their ballots. They kept replacing machines. Mary Zander, who was supposed to retire, and Steve Duchesne said she could work longer. I can't prove it, but I think she cut a deal with Steve Duchesne because he was good at what he did. She destroyed the ballots less than 24 hours after the election. And at the precincts, at the polls, God, I can't think. There was a couple top reporters. Gills. Was there a Gills that somehow owned the newspaper or was chief manager or something? Gills. Write that down. That would have to be looked up. G-I-L-E-S, I think.
Giles? That might be Giles?
Giles. Yeah, Giles. There was top echelon from the Detroit newspaper agency that worked the polls against the people they wanted out of office. Is that ever heard of?
So the Detroit newspaper strike, mm-hmm. was very much an election.
Oh yeah, they were in the they one of them was one of the schools here on 15 Mile because Benny and his wife worked that poll. See, now, you know, I really feel bad. Benny and his wife worked that poll. Benny must have been identified. See, now I'm starting to connect my own dots. Benny was hurt after that. Benny and his wife worked that poll for me. Because I remember it was so cold and she come over with her little boy, Aaron, and a little doll. And they worked that poll for me and they were telling me, yeah, Giles, something with the newspaper industry. Him and a couple top echelon were working that poll.
Well, Ms. Arnold, I want to thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Like you can see, this has an impact on your life. You're asking what's the impact. I guess you can best describe how I get.
It sounds like something's touched you very deeply.
Yes, it does. And there's something about that strike that there's things that you just they're implanted. They're totally implanted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then there was a lot of other goofy things that happened, not goofy things. There was 2 young men that were going to work and they weren't paying attention and they had the trucks lined up on Mound Road. They had them lined up and stopped. And they weren't paying attention and they pile drove their car. It went underneath the truck and they were both decapitated. That accident should have never happened. They should not have had those trucks waiting there. The police would stop traffic and they would have those trucks line up so that they would go through lots of them.
Oh, what a tragedy.
There's something else that happened in the city during the strike, and it should have never happened. And I don't know who to blame for this, but the Detroit newspaper agency claimed that they never lost a day of circulation. What they did is they would print their whatever their number was. I'll give a fictitious number, 100,000. They would print them. That doesn't mean they got delivered. Sitting in the house, and I hear helicopters. I'm looking out there, what the heck? Well, I said more than that. They're popping up, and they're going this way. I called the guys that were, they had a strike office on 15 Mile and Mound. I said, what's going on? And they said, they got helicopters flying down Mound Road. They're taking the papers out of the plant because we've got all the gates locked to stop the circulation to force them into negotiations. I said, you got what? So I went down to the strike office and I stood there and I saw helicopters back and forth flying barely over the wires, the telephone poles. Which is dangerous. Their phone, their strike phone is ringing off the hook. I said, give me the phone. I said to one of the residents, this is Councilwoman Arnold. I don't have a clue what's going on. Call Steve Duchesne. I don't have a clue. I tried calling the Federal Aviation, what's the initials? FAA. I tried calling them, deaf ears. I tried bringing it up at council, deaf ears. I said, as council people, we should have that investigated. Did they get permission? Who did they get permission from? Why were helicopters flying so low? That was for the health, safety, and welfare of its residents. That should have never been. But the Federal Aviation Commission never contacted me. And I don't know what Steve Duchesne told him. I don't know what the Detroit newspaper agency told him. And then strikes are weird. You have people that say, okay, you were on council. Why don't you do something about it? Well, what did they want me to do? I did what I was supposed to do. I screamed at Steve Duchesne. I called the Federal Aviation Commission. I tried to bring it up at the council meeting. It was pushed under the rug. But so much was going on that the next day something else can't happen. And that's round about the time when I had that, what do they call, see now my mind is starting to forget. There's a resolution. I had that resolution written up by an attorney and presented at council the Janet Reno investigate. The Detroit newspaper agency and to make both sides go to the table and negotiate. That was right about that time. I got a lot of publicity on that, but went nowhere. So, you know, as I talk, there's more I'm remembering. I mean, there was helicopters. They were going up and down Mound Road like you wouldn't believe. Oh, do you want to see the site? Get kind of a visual?
If we're done, yes, I will.
For this time. Do you want a coffee or anything before we go? Do you want to go use the restroom?
I want to thank you very much.
Oh.
And
are you sure your voice is getting picked up? Because I talk loud.